Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:36 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is June 17th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with Target. It's breaking down again, and this is a really incredibly abrupt decline. And we got to think about it. Like a month ago, the price was around 225. Now it's 139. So, I mean, this is a really substantial breakdown, and it's still going. But the root cause of it is the overbuy. So, retailers were in a tough position. During 2020, there was the sharp pullback. Then the market was flooded with liquidity, and most particularly, consumers were thrown money into had money thrown into their pockets. So they went out and spent it, and retailers were under a great deal of pressure. They had to try and make the best of this windfall. So they had to ensure that they had enough of inventory, but there was supply bottlenecks. We had this massive surge in demand and factories struggling to keep up with these new orders. So that was a significant event. In order to secure adequate supply, companies would have overordered. Now they are in the position where demand is starting to level off and might have even be falling. And certainly, inflationary pressures have been ramping higher, and the kinds of things that people really see have are feel in their daily lives when the price rises, like oil and food and electricity and natural gas, for that matter. All of those things have jumped up in value, so it has, and people, of course, only have so much disposable income, so at they've been buying less stuff. So Target has decided that they're going to try and liquidate that inventory. And they might even be liquidating it at a loss. So that is obviously weighing on the share. But then yesterday, you had the Biden administration levying price controls on the shipping industry. And let's look at some of those container companies. So the shipping industry is very varied, and you've got lots of different kinds of ships. But Textainer, for example, they focus on container ships, and it did really well. From March of 2020, it went from 5 to 40, so an eightfold increase is none too shabby. It got all the way back to the peaks from back in 2012 and 13. Now it's rolling over and breaking down in here right now. But the primary business is transporting containers around the world. So these types of companies do well when there's lots of containers moving around. They don't do as well when there aren't. And the fact that it is now breaking down and clearly trending lower, well, then this is obviously a sign of stress for the container shipping industry. So what I thought was especially interesting was the shipping industry's response to this price control effort by the Biden administration. They said that warehouses are already full. Now, we've already heard that kind of thing from Target. Now we're hearing it from shipping companies that warehouses all over the USA are full. Now, if they're full and demand is starting to moderate, and we've had a massive build-out of warehouse capacity over the course of the last decade, so to say that those warehouses are full, well, then it suggests that there's an awful lot of inventory that hasn't been bought yet and that will be liquidated. So then let's just focus once more on these retailers. So Walmart had the big failed upside break at the beginning of this year, and then it came crashing straight down, massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Paused in the region of a 1,000-day moving average and is right on its low. Then if we think about just food retail, so Kroger accelerated higher on strong earnings at the beginning of this year. Now it is giving up the entire advance. Then let's just think about the e-commerce sector. Etsy had been performing admirably all the way through from 2020 to the end of 2021, going from about 50 to 300. Now it's back to 73. Now, arguably, it's losing downside momentum, and it's not like Etsy is going to disappear, but it's certainly priced in a lot less bullishness. Shopify has done way worse. They got up to almost $1,700 down to 319 and back in the region of the 2020 lows. So the entire pandemic bonus has been excised from the share price. Now we're starting to see that oil prices are rolling over. Now, I think it's interesting that we can look at this week. Libya has seen a million barrels a day taken out of supply, and that's a significant factor. Then you have OPEC. They're probably going to be put under pressure by the Biden administration to raise production. It's heavy oil. It's difficult to bring online. And Saudi Arabia has rarely pumped at that full capacity figure. So it's not going to happen immediately, even if they were to decide to go full bore. And then oil prices are coming down, not up, into this environment. So the reason interest rates are rising is because of inflation. But the primary rationale for raising interest rates is to curtail demand. So, arguably, we're now starting to see evidence of that. So, we have the big inventory build in the retail sector, and the retail sector is really underperforming. Now we're starting to see oil rolling over, and it is worth looking at the individual contracts because when we look at those individual contracts, then that step lower that we saw at the beginning of this month is going to be excised, and we see that it got up to a new high, failed. And now it's failing in a more dynamic manner than it broke out. So there is certainly the potential here that oil prices could come back to at least test the 100, if not the $90 area. And that at least would help to moderate some of the inflationary pressures, but it could come back more. One thing that I'm particularly cautious about is it's quite normal to see the commodity complex do exceptionally well in the latter stages of an economic expansion. And there is no question that the energy sector in particular has done exceptionally well. And it's been the best performing sector in 2021 and 2022. Well, Exxon has now posted the largest downward dynamic that we've seen in years, bigger than the individual downward dynamics we've seen since the big acceleration lower in March of 2020. But this suggests a peak of at least near-term significance. The price got all the way up to a new high, and at the bare minimum, we're going to see some consolidation in this area. Now, it still yields 4%, and people will continue to hold it because of the yield, because Exxon pulled out every available stop to ensure that they could sustain their dividend. And the dividend payout ratio is high. So they're paying out 67% or 65.7% of all their profits in dividends, and they're buying back shares. So that also suggests that they're not spending a lot of money on new supply. And that's been a hallmark of this entire pandemic environment. Oil prices have recovered and done so in a really dynamic manner. And the public markets are not willing to give additional funds to the energy sector to supplement additional new supply. So Comstock is being taken private again. And that's possible because the owner and the founder of the company is a 70% owner of it, so he can just simply take it private. And then he'll go off and find private money to fund additional new natural gas drilling. Well, this is certainly something that we're seeing more of, that companies are either going private or staying private. And if they want to then invest in things like coal or natural gas or oil, then they're going to private investors for the capital. But because it's politically toxic to do that, then the yields that are on offer are quite high. But I did hear, for example, of a natural gas, a private natural gas deal going through here in Dallas this morning, and it was going for approximately 7 times sales. So, or sorry, 7 times profits. So that's not overly aggressive in a high price environment, but it would be very difficult to get that deal done on the public markets. And I've definitely seen that people are having difficulty raising money from the public investors, like pension funds. So we're not seeing the clear supply response, and the number of wells that are in fact working is comparatively low. So this is obviously problematic. Now, when we think about the downward pressure that we're seeing on oil, it's being mirrored in the mining sector. And Glencore came through with really outstanding profits in here today. And they said that they made more money trading in the first half of this year than they were anticipating making for the whole year. And that's the kind of unabashed good news that anyone logically would think would support the price. But we had a downside key reversal last week, and we had downside follow-through in here this week. And this isn't really encouraging. So we can see that there's a downside key reversal in late April, and we got another one now. And arguably, this is a softening up process. We had this discussion in the chart seminar about Anglo American. So we had the downside key reversal, but no real follow-through, and then a rebound. Things were looking fine. Then last week we had another downside key reversal and follow through this week, and now it's back in the region of the 200-day moving average. So it really needs to bounce and do so in a clear, dynamic manner and soon to avoid a much deeper process of consolidation. And this is arguably true of just about all of the resources sector. So let's go back and think about cyclicality. The mining sector, the resources sector, generally energy, they tend to do well in the latter stages of a bull market because inflationary pressures are beginning to rise, but interest rates haven't yet gone up enough to bite. And in between, you see that resources tend to do particularly well because people tend to accelerate their purchases. So then prices go up, and investments in new supply take time, so then it takes time for that supply response to feed through. Well, eventually then prices start to come back down because interest rates start to bite and because the investments in new supply in fact start to come online. And then that usually happens at the front end of a new bear market trend and a recession. So then copper prices are back on the $4 area. Now, I look at copper and this evolving trend here, and it looks like a top formation. And I don't think there's any getting away from that. And I was worried about copper, so I sold my long in the copper miners sector about, it must be nearly 2 months ago now. So we're in this really rather interesting situation. Is this a consolidation following the breakout from a 14-year range? In which case, we should anticipate that we're in a new secular bull market. Or is this another example of a big move after a bear decline, like we saw between 2009 and 2011? And that when interest rates do start to bite, that it will be completely eroded. There has been something of a supply response. Certainly, there hasn't been the massive investments in new mines that would accompany a secular trend. And there is a trend towards electrification, but electrification is capital intense. You have to basically go off and build it all first. Then you can reap the benefits later. So you need adequate capital to first build it, then tide you over a while the transition goes through, and then to obviously iron out all of the issues with the technology. And time is money. So as interest rates rise, then the rationale for investing in electric vehicles and mass electrification and eating into the global demand for oil, it's just not as convincing in a higher interest rate environment. And if the global economy slows down, and copper is often regarded as Dr. Copper because it's used in every country in the world, then if it breaks down, it suggests that we are moving more into a difficult economic growth environment. Now, let's also then think about the longer term trends of liquidity. So, the high yield spread is above 500 basis points, and that doesn't happen all that often. But when it happens, it's usually coinciding with stress in the stock market. Now, we've had plenty of stress in the stock market already, but the move through 500 basis points is generally not a good thing. And it suggests that we're going to have additional stress in the credit markets and in the stock market. The yield curve spread has inverted in March, then rebounded, but didn't rebound a lot. And then it was inverted again earlier on this week, and we're currently around 6 basis points and pushing lower. And there's always an argument about whether the yield curve spread is really indicative of the conditions prevailing right now, or whether this time is in fact different. But the reality is that when short-term rates rise above long-term rates, well, it sends a clear signal. And the first is that if long-term rates aren't rising at least as fast as short-term rates, well, then investors are starting to price in that the current inflationary pressures aren't going to persist, and that the and the, obviously the logical corollary is that deflation is something that we should be worried about in future. Then, what I think is interesting, and it has fed through to this argument that this time is different, is that there's a clear divergence between the 10-year minus the 3-month and the 10-year minus the 2-year. So the 10-year minus the 3-month is only just starting to roll over, but it's been cited by the Federal Reserve and Jay Powell as an indicator that financial conditions are still fine. But nothing could be further from the truth. So If we look at the 3 month yield, it was up today. It's up at 1.56%. That's still lower than the Fed funds rate. So I don't think anybody thinks that the Fed isn't going to raise rates by 50 basis points again when they meet again in July. But the 10-year yield is coming down. So that's beginning to price in the potential that investors are willing to at least give the benefit of the doubt to the potential that at least someone else wants to buy with a yield of somewhere around 3.5%. Now, we didn't have a dynamic move in here today, but the 10-month minus the 3-month is generally the yield curve spread that people tend to watch for confirmation. By the time the recession actually starts, it would be normal to anticipate that every portion of the yield curve will be inverted. And we're probably going to be a while away from that level. But one thing that I think is interesting is in speaking with a subscriber this morning, he was saying that around the Oklahoma panhandle and the Texas panhandle, farmers are beginning to buy tanks for diesel so that they can buy directly from the refinery and take a full truckload. So that would be 8,500 gallon tanks. And that's an outlay of something like $36,000. So they get to buy it at $4. Obviously, that's substantially lower than they'd have to pay if they were buying on a piecemeal basis. And it's another example of how people have been accelerating their purchases. And when you've got as much as you need, then you stop buying. I think this is happening in the retail sector. I think it's happening in the energy sector. But it's also happening in the semiconductors sector. So we can think about companies like GM. And they had really big problems with sourcing enough of chips for their vehicles, and they weren't able to buy as many chips as they are to, they weren't able to build as many cars as they might like. And they've had to really work hard to try and raise prices enough to compensate for the fact that they can't build as many cars as they want. VW was in a similar situation. So faced with a massive shortage and an inability to source the products that they need, it's quite likely that they overordered. And now those share prices are coming down and still trending lower. So we're still in a rather bearish environment. It's quite likely that the growth that we've seen in companies like Nvidia, where the share has steadied over the course of the last couple of days, and it's now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Or we can think about ASML, where they have an order book stretching for years, and the share is breaking downwards. Microchip technology is another example. And it's broken downwards in here today and closing below the 1,000-day moving average. So these types of companies, they saw their earnings really multiply, and the number of orders jump in a really impressive manner. And now they're starting to see that their orders will start to evaporate, and that the people who've already bought as many as they needed and probably enough for years of their supply, well, they're just not going to need them for a while. And that's going to be seriously problematic for these kinds of companies. So what we're looking at is the real potential that the party is over. And one thing that I'm concerned about And I guess I've said that a couple of times now, so there's a couple of things that I'm concerned about. It certainly inventory is one of them, but it's also that there's a broad consensus to expect a recession in 2023, maybe 2024. But nobody's really willing to give any credence to the view that maybe we could have a recession in 2022. We've had one negative quarter of growth already. The next GDP growth figure is going to be at the end of this quarter. And the Federal Reserve said yesterday that they think growth is recovering after the decline in the first quarter. But we've had a massive jump higher in the price of food, energy, heating, and cooling. So, and transportation. So that's going to have a knock-on effect. And we can think about then this broad commodity complex where we've had really quite significant strength. And I think it's also particularly relevant here. Natural gas prices are coming back down. So they were down 44 cents in here today. And this is obviously a response to the shutting down of export capacity in Texas. Now, that's going to allow a lot more gas circulate in the US market, and it should help to bring prices back down. But we're also seeing that gas prices are coming back down in Europe. And that doesn't gel with the narrative. Why would natural gas prices be coming down in the UK and coming down in mainland Europe when exports from the USA are being curtailed? Well, maybe it's because there's going to be less demand. And we can then think about how some of these stock markets are performing. So the Euro Stoxx index, it got all the way up above 450 and failed. So now it's below the 1,000-day moving average. And this is a big failure. And we're pushing down into the underlying trading range that proceeded from 2015 to 2020. Europe is under extraordinary duress because of the twin facts that they're not able to buy from Russia anymore. And when they used to buy energy from Russia, they got to pay in euro. So they don't get to pay in euros anymore, and they're not even buying it. But it also helps to highlight that the just wrongheadedness of the ESG movement. Europe has been the pioneer of championing the environment and the ESG movement. So they go off and they tell their supplier that they're not going to be needing oil and gas from them anymore. And now they're experiencing some surprise that their biggest supplier has said that they don't want to sell it to them anymore. And this is obviously problematic. But I think it's also interesting that the wind sector is trending downwards and is closing out the week below the 1,000-day moving average. And the solar ETF has also been pulling back. Now, it was off its low in here today. You would think that with the pressure on supply and the clear necessity to rebuild inventories of natural gas in Europe, that they'd be investing in any and all types of alternatives. So solar is obviously one of those. And at least it is off its lows in here, but it isn't above the 200-day moving average yet. But certainly it's looking better than the wind sector right now. As we think then about the global environment, well, we're definitely seeing that there are knock-on repercussions right around the world and between markets because of this invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And then you have China, where Xi Jinping wants to become leader for life. And in order to do that, he is selling himself as capable of achieving a really significant victory. So then I think the regular person is going to be thinking, well, what could possibly be that victory? It's not going to be the pandemic and how it was handled. So the other great leaders in China have obviously had major victories. Even a comparatively weak leader like Hu Jintao was got the kudos of welcoming the leaders of just about every major country to the Olympics in 2008. So then, what is it that Xi Jinping can offer? Well, the easy answer is that he's saying he needs to be leader for life so that he can deliver Taiwan. Now, delivering Taiwan doesn't necessarily have to happen militarily. The Kuomintang has basically been taken over by the Communist Party, and the Kuomintang was based upon the ideal of reunification. So, reunification obviously was initially envisioned as on their own terms, but I think they would probably prefer a reunification over a war. So, China certainly has the potential to take Taiwan by force, but they're probably going to try the diplomatic route first. And that would probably create bigger problems for the rest of the world. Because if Taiwan were to vote and decide that they were going to, in fact, voluntarily reunite with China, there's not a lot the rest of the world can do about it. But then suddenly, China would own the most significant manufacturing for semiconductors in the world. And would the rest of the world allow that to happen? So, this is obviously a significant factor. Then I think it's also interesting what's going on in terms of the inventory of arms. So, China's about to launch its third aircraft carrier. The only reason you need aircraft carriers is to project power internationally. So, they're going to continue building aircraft carriers. Russia is using up a lot of industrial material in Ukraine, and they're using Soviet-era tanks. Rheinmetall has released the plans for its new tank. They're saying it's a groundbreaker, but they're also repurposing and some of the old Soviet-era, or I guess, well, Cold War-era tanks. Approximately 200 of them, so that they can be given by Germany to the Ukraine and go off there to get destroyed. So we're seeing a dissolution of military hardware, because that's what happens during wars. And then there'll be the clear intention in Europe that they're going to have to get people to work. They're going to have an excuse for stimulus. Well, rearming will certainly be a part of that. And I think it's interesting, though, that even though there's a war going on, even though there's a lot of military hardware getting used up, well, the aerospace and defense ETF broke downwards in here this week. So the real benefits for this sector would be when additional liquidity starts to become available. So now let's think about what's happening on Wall Street. Well, the S&P 500 was steadier in here today, but we've had a meaningful pullback this week, and it's in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is a potential area of support. It's still a very consistent downtrend where we have a series of ranges, one below another, and those ranges are encountering resistance in the region of the lower side of the overhead trading range. But this is the do or die area. In a secular bull market, stock market indices bounce from the 1,000-day moving average. And they don't bounce during secular bear markets, and they trend through it. But we can go back and look at previous bull markets, and we have plenty of evidence that there are medium-term corrections, and even in a crashy kind of scenario, the region of the 1,000-day moving average held. So when we get really big divergences relative to that 1,000-day moving average, it's a warning. We've had one of those. Now it's been unwound. And the big question is, are we going to see a substantial rebound? And there's the potential that that will be the case. So what are the two things that would contribute to a medium-term low being found and a resumption of the bull market? Well, I think the first would be lower inflation, and the second would be central banks relenting so that they would stop raising rates or they would start cutting them again. So it's kind of like a good news is bad news story and vice versa. If we have bad news that the economy is hurting, that stagflation jumps, that and then inflation starts to roll over, or that we get price controls introduced, which automatically tends to bring down inflation, well, then central banks won't have to raise as much, and stocks will respond accordingly. So that's one potential outcome. Then, of course, there's the scope that we go into a recession, and then central banks panic, and they see that they've tightened conditions too much already. So they start to ease up again, and then we see the market rebound in a really impressive manner. Of course, the worst case scenario is that inflation continues higher and that we might have an economic contraction, but inflation doesn't turn around. And the deficits that have been built up over the years, they're going to come back and bite us, that the number of people retiring is going to continue to escalate. There will be a labor shortage. You'll get a cost labor spiral, and then you end up with a really difficult inflationary environment. You need much higher rates to get it under control. So there's obviously these three different options. Now, when we think about the gold price, well, gold is hovering here around the $1,850 area, and it was up in a reasonably dynamic manner for 2 days and then down today. It's going to have to do better than that. It's going to have to at least push up and out of this range in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But at least it's holding the sequence of higher reaction lows within this range that's been forming now for most of the last 18 months. In a very difficult stock market environment where people have to sell what they can rather than what they want, well, then gold will be subject to additional volatility. But then when the contagion setting stops, gold would be expected to rally back much more impressively. And it kind of did that in 2020. The price pulled back sharply from about 1850 to 1700 and a lot closer really to 1650, and then rebounded impressively. If we are in a situation where central banks aren't willing to follow through and we start to see unemployment rising and that acting as a catalyst for somewhat easier monetary policy, well, then that's going to be very beneficial for asset prices and gold in particular. What I find interesting is that stocks are capable of bouncing just because we've got some bad news about the economy or that oil prices are pulling back. I remain of the view that Bitcoin is a lightning rod for liquidity. and it broke below the 30,000 level. We're now trading at 20,000. I think it's important to look at the longer term chart because this is a substantial break below the 1,000-day moving average. And in every other crypto winter, it's bounced from the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So if it's going to start bouncing, it would really need to start getting on with it. The other big consistency characteristic for major crypto bull markets is that the price has never fallen through a previous spike peak. Now, I find that interesting. The first is that it's a known fact. But of course, if we just look at the chart, we had a spike peak in early 2020. The price went up through it to nearly $70,000 and failed. So that is the price pulling back down through a spike peak. But obviously, most people don't pay attention to that. What we have now is the price in the region of this 1900 or 19,511 peak price from back in 2017. And if the price is going to bounce, well, then this is the area for that to happen. And if we pull back through that, it'll be an additional inconsistency within the trend. One thing that I think is especially relevant is that bull markets make big promises. And perhaps Tesla has made the biggest promises of all. They pioneered the electric vehicle. And then they've said that they're developing autonomous driving. And this autonomous driving is now being investigated by the US government. So they want to know what's the effect of braking and do the brakes actually work? They're looking at things like the autonomous driving and whether it's killing people. There's lots of factors. And then, of course, you hear these other stories about Teslas in landfills spontaneously combusting and becoming really problematic. So I don't think there's anything has really been done to allow for the fact that Teslas are made of exceptionally volatile materials. So the share price is coming back down towards the region of this 1,000-day moving average as well. But it's got a lot of work to do to demonstrate that this is a meaningful area of support. If we just simply think about what is it that Elon Musk is doing? Well, he is a successful company in Tesla, and he has a large number of potential points of litigation facing him with regard to Tesla. SpaceX is an incredibly innovative company worth an awful lot of money, and certainly will benefit from not having any kind of controversy. And then, of course, you have the people that work at work inside Tesla, and how well are they being compensated, and what exactly are they doing to create an autonomous driving phenomenon? Are we going to get to a point where we're going to see all the emails within Tesla being read by ambitious attorneys? And will it be revealed that autonomy is nonsense? This is obviously Elon Musk's worst case, or he's probably his nightmare scenario. So what's he doing? He's buying Twitter. And that is a major media outlet. He's also cozying up to Republicans. So he said, "Oh, I've changed my politics. I now vote Republican." So he's obviously betting that Republicans are going to be in power, and it's going to be beneficial for him to have friends in high places to obviate the risk of litigation. So there's certainly a lot of activity going on in Tesla, and the share continues to come back down towards the 1,000-day moving average. Well, Amazon has broken down, and it's pulling back from the 1,000-day moving average and just about holding support in the psychological $100 level. Google, which I continue to regard as a highly innovative company, is also still trending downwards. So we've had really significant deterioration in the trends of some of these large companies. And lots of other companies have pulled back in even more dynamic fashions. So Apple has now broken down from its most recent range and is coming back into the region of the 200-day moving average. This, of course, isn't the first time it's done this. So it's going to have to bounce, though, from the region of that 1,000-day moving average in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Lots of the smaller companies have collapsed. So Zoom Media has at least started to pause here around the $100 level. It's completely unwound the boom and bust relating to the pandemic. So it's potentially starting to build a base formation. When we think about RingCentral, I've been on a number of meetings using RingCentral, and their app doesn't work very well. And there's no evidence yet that it has stopped declining. I was looking today at the biotechnology sector because this pattern of exceptional outperformance followed by collapse, we saw that in the immuno-oncology companies back in 2016 through 18. So Bluebird Bio, for example, went from about 25 to 150, and then gave up the entire advance. And Clovis Oncology did the same thing. In fact, it probably came down even more. It's down 99% from the peak in 2018. But it's a big upside key day reversal. At least there's some evidence that demand is coming back into dominance, and there have been occasions when it has been able to rally in a reasonably impressive fashion, even within the context of the downtrend. But the factor behind this is we're starting to see M&A activity coming through in the biotech sector. So, Seagen might be taken over or at least have a joint venture with Merck. And then Legend is, or excuse me, Ligand is a similar type of company where it's starting to bounce from the lower side of the range. Now, there is a company called Legend Biotech, and that one has a similar pattern to Seagen. So it's bouncing from the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, what this also says is that even in an environment where there is a lot of weakness in stocks, there are areas that can do well. Now, energy looks like it's rolling over, but the biotech sector, it was looking like it was going to do well in the I guess around 2021, and then it rolled over. And it rolled over because companies like Moderna had rallied so much that they completely dominated the market cap of the index. And Moderna is now down from 450 to 100. So that has greatly reduced its weighting within the biotech sector. We're starting to see that some of these immuno-oncology companies are beginning to find support. So the Loncar Cancer Immunotherapy ETF has begun to bounce. Now, we're talking about exceptionally depressed shares here. And I think you could argue pretty successfully that these types of instruments aren't owned by people that were buying a lot of ETFs. So the risk of liquidation has greatly reduced. But of course, they need the bullish catalyst. They need this M&A activity to enhance. The reality is that what happens in terms of vaccines in the pandemic isn't going to have a great deal of impact on immuno-oncology. The reason that they did so well in 2017 was because it was the commercialization of these therapies, and there was a huge amount of enthusiasm that it would be scalable. But the absence of scalability, because each of the solutions needs to be tailored, well, then that became problematic. And then we can think about the Editas and gene editing technology, and it's pulled back really exceptionally quickly, but just beginning to find support as well. So there is the potential that we're going to see a significant rotation, and that the resources sector has been doing exceptionally well and is rolling over, and that portions of the high technology sector will start to outperform once more. Well, that's not especially interest rate sensitive, because these types of companies, they can raise money from private equity, and there's still plenty of money floating around in private equity. And they'll be able to keep going because the rewards are so high. So they offer optionality both for investors and for pharmaceutical companies, which will eventually buy them. And this happens outside of the broad interest rate and liquidity cycle. One thing that's especially relevant is that the dollar continues to strengthen. And it pulled back in on Wednesday and Thursday and then rebounded in here today. So we're getting some back and forth action, and the yen weakened really quite abruptly in here today. So the Bank of Japan is still willing to go it alone. They don't believe that inflation is going to last indefinitely. They don't see it domestically, so they're just not going to deviate from their policies, at least not yet. And the yen took another, that this is another clear downward dynamic for the yen and upward dynamic for the dollar. The stronger the dollar is, the more pressure it puts on consumption around the world. And it especially puts pressure on sovereigns and companies that have been borrowing in US dollars. Well, that's especially a factor for China, but it's certainly also true for much of the rest of the emerging markets world. And then we can think about India. So India is buying Russian oil, and they're up to over 30 million barrels a month. So that's almost a million barrels a day. But the stock market is beginning to pull back. Then you have Reliance Industries. So Reliance is, it does lots of things. So they're primarily a refinery, but they also own the 4G network. And there is talk that they're looking to potentially buy Revlon out of bankruptcy. But Reliance is able to buy Russian oil, process it, refine it, sell it domestically, and then potentially also export it. So this is a graphic example of how Russian commodities are going to make their way out into the world. By one way or another, new supply chains are going to emerge. And obviously, that's going to help the shortage of commodities situation. But the demand growth factor is what's most important right now. And we can think about the liquidity conditions, where high yield spreads are rising, we have an inverted yield curve, or we've ha and or darn close to it, on the 10-year and the 2-year. We're seeing that Europe in particular is experiencing exceptional stress. Now, one thing that is also relevant for Europe right now is the heat wave. And it's unusual to have such a big heat wave in Europe at this time of the year. And it suggests that there's going to be demand for air conditioning. Now, the ESG movement, they don't want people to get air conditioning. What they're arguing is that what we really need to do is focus on cooling down the atmosphere. But that's a multi-decade problem. And in the meantime, people are going to be in very uncomfortable situations when we do get these heat waves. So wouldn't it just be simple to build more electricity generating capacity and then just facilitate people buying air conditioners? Of course, that's an additional cost for most consumers at a time when consumers are already under pressure from inflation. So there's no real easy answer. And Europe is having the screws tightened on it in terms of its natural gas. So Europe is now using the gas that they've been trying to build up their inventories with. It raises the real potential that within the next 6 months, Europe is going to be in a dire situation in terms of its energy. And that also suggests that the weakness that we're getting in oil right now, it might not last all that long. So we can give the benefit of the doubt to the downside in the short term, but over the medium term, with a 6-month horizon, there is still the potential that we're going to have a difficult energy environment and that we're going to have lower growth overall. So it's a time to be cautious. And when there's evidence of deep value, then perhaps it's time to start accumulating positions. But the one thing that I remember this morning David saying many times, and it is, don't pay up for commodities. And commodities are kind of expensive right now. So oil prices have been going up a lot, and now they're starting to come back down. And we're starting to see choppy action after accelerated moves. So this is a peak of at least near-term and potentially medium-term significance. And we can also think about the really impressive advance we've seen on Shell, and then this whopping downward dynamic in here today. When we think about BP, the European oil companies are going to pull back faster because of the clear and present danger of surprise windfall taxes. Obviously, the USA is talking about it, but they haven't done it yet. We're moving into a more uncertain environment, and it's really going to be a big question. What are central banks going to do? Because if we look at these long-term charts of bond yields, it's arguable whether the trend has in fact yet been broken. So every time it's tested the sequence of lower rally highs, it's being a buying op it, it has been a buying opportunity. So we're now in the region of 3.25. There's the potential that we're already at the hurdle rate, and that beyond here, it's going to have a meaningful effect on speculative interest. So I do think that we need to at least consider that growth is going to surprise on the downside, and that we could start to see recessionary problems arise soon. And that could have a knock-on effect on employment, which would then necessitate that central banks begin to think about what else they can do. Because Larry Summers is talking about an unemployment rate of 6% to control US inflation. And that's a really deep recession. So when we start to think in those terms, when we see big overbought conditions, it's a time to take profits. When we start to see consistency characteristics deteriorate, then that's the time to take profits. When we see really deep oversold conditions and some evidence of support coming back in, well, then it's time to nibble. But in between those two conditions, it's just the weight of, or the balance of probabilities and the weight of risk versus reward just isn't there. So we're still in a rather dicey situation where having patience is going to pay off better than probably anything else. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.